So the first thing I want to do is acknowledge my collaborators, Sarah Chen, who is here in the audience, Molly Metzger and Sherita Butler-Barnes, both assistant professors at WashU at the Brown School, along with me. Now, there's a couple things that I want you to keep in mind as I go through this presentation. And I know that I'm sort of speaking to the choir here, but the first is where Latinos are primarily located in the United States. And these are 2010 data, so this is the most recent data that we could find about the distribution. Of course, the Southwest, Florida, Illinois, New York have over 20% of their population is Latino. The second is the distribution of the different Latino national ethnic groups across the country, right? And of course, Mexicans are about 60-65% of the Latino population, and they sort of predominate in most of the U.S. Puerto Ricans are the red there in the Northeast, and obviously in Puerto Rico, and somehow we made it all the way to Hawaii. We must love islands. Cubans are down in Florida, in the green. The purple is folks from El Salvador that are primarily in the D.C., Maryland, Virginia area. And I don't know if you can see the yellow. That is the Dominican population, which is also in the Northeast, in New York primarily, but also in places like Rhode Island here in Massachusetts as well. So the first thing that I wanted to tell you about violence is that it's a huge problem. It's the second leading cause of death for Latino youth, 10 to 24 years of age. It falls between that of African Americans and whites, but once we start disaggregating Latinos by national origin and immigrant generation, we see a much more complicated pattern of risk. Now, this is sort of the progression of research that has been done on Latinos and youth violence. And the first thing that you probably all know is that we are all 21 countries under this pan-ethnic label. So most of the research has really not made a big differentiation between the racial and the ethnic groups within the Latino population. Then we sort of went into results by specific groups, but what was happening there is that people were comparing, say, Puerto Ricans, Cubans, Mexicans to non-Latino whites in their studies. And really, these categories were used sort of as covariates and multivariate analysis. And so the story of the results is still really about non-Latino whites and not about any specific Latino group. Now, we're now at a different stage where we are starting to compare the Latino groups to each other and sort of trying to understand what is most relevant for specific Latino subgroups that, as I sort of showed here, live in different parts of the country. They have different social contexts. So our research question, and this is one in a series of studies, is, well, how do multiple dimensions of neighborhood characteristics affect the risk for violent behaviors among Latinos? And we were really interested in examining social dynamic, economic status of a neighborhood, the racial and ethnic composition of a neighborhood, and community resources. Our second question was, well, if we start to disaggregate that Latino pan-ethnic label into the different national origin subgroups, do these associations hold for the different groups? So we use the National Longitudinal Study of Adolescent Health, or AdHealth. Many of you are familiar with it. I'm not going to go into the details of AdHealth, but two things merit mentioning. They oversampled Cubans and Puerto Ricans to allow, and about 1,500 Mexicans fell naturally into the sample. So this allowed for a much more nuanced subgroup analysis. And for this particular study, we only are looking at self-identified Latinos or Hispanics, and these were under the categories of Mexican, Mexican-American, Chicano, Cuban, Cuban-American, Puerto Rican, Central and South American, and other Latino, but those numbers were too small, so we ended up grouping them together. Overall, they made up about 17% of the total AdHealth sample, so that's a fairly, you know, with a national sample, that's a fairly good number to do this kind of analysis. Now, some of you have probably seen descriptives of AdHealth, and these might look a bit different. The average age across the board was 16, and males made about 51% of the population. Now, within Latinos, the immigrant generations are actually, there's a fairly good distribution across groups. 25% were first-generation immigrants, 33% were second-generation, and about 43% were third-generation or above. Now, the average family income for Latinos was $32,000 a year, and this is compared to $45,000 a year among the general sample, the overall sample of at health. When it comes to mothers' education, 45% of our Latino sample had mothers with less than a high school education. That's compared to 15% for the entire at-health population. So we're really looking at a group that has low levels of socioeconomic status and stability in their homes. Now, we looked at also household composition, and I like to have different kinds of household compositions than anybody else. So we looked at two parents only, which were about 50% of our sample. We also looked at households that had an additional adult kin in the home, so sort of thinking that, well, if there's two adults in the house, that is equal to, you know, two adults in the house, two parents, not necessarily. And then we looked at single-parent households or households where the adolescent lived with an adult kin that was not their parent, so no biological parents in the household. Now, our measure of violent behaviors was an interesting one. We were able to distinguish between sort of moderate and more severe forms of violent behaviors. We conducted some preliminary analysis, and these sort of held together. But this allowed us to conduct an ordinal logistic regression. Now, many of you know that these kinds of events are thankfully rare events, so they were not normally distributed, and log transformations didn't really correct for that. So we ended up using a three-level variable where people were categorized as having engaged in no violent behavior in the previous year, in moderate behaviors, or if they engaged in at least one of the severe violent behaviors, they were put in that category. Now, of course, this is very severe kinds of violent behaviors, you know, shot, stab someone, that sort of thing. Now, we looked at the four contextual measures. The first was social dynamics, and that was made up by a measure of adolescents' perceptions of social cohesion in their neighborhoods. Residential stability, which means owner-occupied homes and the proportion of homes that have had their occupants for more than 5 years. We created a socioeconomic well-being index, and I always like to look at the positive things. And this had both educational, wealth, professional occupations. And on the flip side, we looked at families under the poverty line, female-headed households with children, and the male unemployment rate, and those were reverse-coded so that higher numbers of socioeconomic status mean more well-being. They're better off. Racial and ethnic composition had two specific measures. The first was the proportion of the population in the neighborhood that was non-Latino or black, and the proportion of the population that were first-generation immigrants. And then for community resources, we had the proportion of idle youth, and these were 16 to 19-year-old youth who were not in school, not in the armed forces, not in college, did not work. They were just not doing anything. And then we also looked at the total direct expenditure on the per capita expenditure on social services at the county level. Now, and I know this has a lot of numbers, so I've highlighted the things that are significant, and I'm going to show them to you in really awesome graphs that my students made for me. But we looked at socioeconomic well-being. We found that Puerto Ricans and Cubans were actually in neighborhoods that had a bit higher socioeconomic status than the rest. Other Latinos were at the sort of the lowest extreme there. The proportion of adolescents that lived in neighborhoods with differing proportions of black youth, we see that among Cubans, they were really very unlikely to live in neighborhoods that had higher proportions of black youth, whereas Puerto Rican youth were on the flip side, right? I say we because I'm also Puerto Rican. We tend to live in neighborhoods that have a much higher proportion of non-Latino blacks. Immigrant concentration, once again, Cubans had neighborhoods where about 62% of the population was first-generation immigrant, and there were also some significant differences in the proportion of idle youth. Now, I want to highlight for a minute the direct expenditure category. Now, we use the global measure of direct expenditure, but I wanted to show this because here we're breaking it down. And you can see that in terms of public welfare and police, Puerto Ricans had much higher levels of expenditure in policing and much lower levels of expenditure when it comes to issues of public welfare. Now, these are the significant differences in a much prettier, less numeric way. And we see, again, economic well-being, percent idle youth, immigrant generation, and percent non-Latino black. Direct expenditures is not here because, taken as a whole, there are not significant differences across the groups. But if you start looking at the specific categories of direct expenditure, that's when you start seeing real differences. Now, just very briefly, this is sort of the distribution of violent behaviors across the different groups. The first line of columns that we'll see is for all Latinos, and we see that about 9.5% of Latino youth at this time were engaging in severe violent behaviors. But there's significant differences across groups, and we can see the lowest level among other Latinos, so the other Latino category, and the highest levels among Puerto Ricans. And of note, the majority of Puerto Ricans were actually engaging in some kind of violent behavior at this time, whether moderate or severe. Now, in our multivariate analysis, we had expected, according to the literature, you know, the more socioeconomic well-being, less risk, the more residential stability, less risk, the more social cohesion, less risk, the more direct expenditure, less risk. But we found very different patterns in our results, and patterns that we were really not expecting. For example, social cohesion was associated with increased risk among that other Latino category, which is what's driving the risk among the all Latino category. Now, when it comes to economic well-being and racial and ethnic composition, the two things that in the majority of the work on youth violence and neighborhood effects has focused on, it seems that it didn't have an effect, at least not in this cross-sectional study, once we were controlling for other community factors and community resources. Now, very interestingly, among Cubans, having sort of moderate levels of idle youth in a neighborhood was associated with fewer, with very interesting. And among Puerto Ricans, the level of direct expenditure was actually associated with much higher risk for severe violent behaviors. And again, that was sort of an interesting and surprising population. Now, you'll see that immigrant concentration was not in the model among Cubans, and that is because there was very little variance there, and it was sort of repetitive. Now, what are our key findings? Well, clearly, levels of severe violent behaviors differ by subgroup, and they can differ widely, with Puerto Ricans being at the highest risk, which previous research has shown before, so we were expecting that. But the impact of neighborhood factors was really not consistent across the board. Now, when we look at issues of social cohesion, we have to sort of understand what social cohesion means, right? What was in that indicator? And part of what was indicator is, do you know your neighbors? Do you stop to talk to your neighbors? Do you feel safe in your neighborhood? Now, it's quite possible that, and being a cross-sectional study, which we're going to follow up with a longitudinal one, we'd like to see how this pans out, but it's very possible that youth at this stage might be engaging. They might know other peers in their neighborhoods and other people in their neighborhood who are also engaging in problematic and risky behaviors, and that might be increasing that risk. There's also the possibility that they're part of some sort of subculture, right? So that if I'm the toughest one in the neighborhood, I will feel safe in my neighborhood because nobody would dare come and sort of attack me, or I wouldn't dare to be I wouldn't be a victim of violence in my neighborhood. And that's sort of a false sense of security, and we know that from the research and the literature, but that might be going on, and we're going to explore that further. We're not totally sure what's going on with that moderate levels of idle youth among Cubans, and if people have any suggestions and ideas, I'm happy to have a conversation with you. But we really need to think about the context in which also Cubans are living, especially in this sample and how they might be, even though they might have a higher level of vital youth, how that they might still be sort of pulling from the social support and networks present in a strong community, in a strong ethnic enclave. And that's something to think about. Now, the direct expenditure piece among Puerto Ricans, and going back to what exactly are we spending on, we really think that that has to do with the amount of policing that's going on. And sort of if you think about the 1990s when this data was first gathered and think about sort of New York, first of all, the Northeast is the most expensive area of the country, maybe not including California, but certainly in the 1990s it was the most expensive. So there was automatically a higher level of expenditure. But also a higher level of expenditure in policing, right? And think about what Giuliani was trying to do during the 1990s, sort of cleaning up New York and cleaning up the city, and how a lot of communities of color, especially young men of color, where they're subjected to excessive policing, right? So we might be seeing this correlation there, and we'd like to also explore that specifically much further. Now, as I said, this is sort of one in multiple studies. It's the third study that I've done with this data set. And from here on in, what we're going to be doing is looking at the long-term trajectories of risk for violent behaviors across each group. And Ed Health allows us to do that looking up to middle adulthood. We're also going to look at it in terms of how it relates to other risk behaviors, such as substance abuse, mental health, problems and risky sexual behaviors, and sort of going back to what Dr. Cepeda was talking about. We are thinking about looking at the risky health behaviors, and of course these are all risky health behaviors, and how they might affect chronic conditions during adulthood, sort of the accumulation of stress and exposure to stressors alongside with these behaviors. And one question that I've had for a while is whether changing neighborhood context, right? If we move, we grow up, we move to a different neighborhood, what are the characteristics of those neighborhoods? Are we sort of going through an upward mobility when it comes to neighborhoods? Are we moving more horizontally? And whether changing neighborhood context can change trajectories of risk among Latinos. And I know that the Moving to Opportunity project was trying to address some of those questions, but certainly not among Latinos, so it's time that we figure that out. Then we're doing questions and comments at the end, so that will be it for now. Thank you.